the 10th, so September 10th. I'm Wendy Edelberg. We have Vince Reinhardt on the phone, and I'll let people introduce themselves.
I'm Alexis Simmendinger with the FCIC writing team.
And I'm Greg Feldberg. I'm the research director.
Hi, Vincent. This is Adam Ball. I'm sitting on this one.
Hello. All right. So we should jump right in. So I think that the first thing that I would love to talk about, thinking a little bit chronologically, is how you think the financial system changed over time. What changes you think were important that had something to do with the financial crisis? Going back as far as you think is relevant.
Okay, so I think there's the real side and the financial side that both interacted. The governmental interventions on the real side mattering a lot, and the structure of regulation mattering a lot on the financial side. Basically, for the last 25 years, we have, as a nation, provided a very high return for financial institutions to get complicated in a couple ways. First, in the U.S. we have multiple regulators. Internationally, we have an intricate tax system, very complicated accounting. And to an important extent, financial innovation, what rocket scientists did was not create new instruments that spanned markets and shed risk, as in the textbook. It was importantly regulatory and tax arbitrage. That a security structured in a certain way had advantages for the final holder. The advantages conveyed because of Basel I and then Basel II, giving preference to securities that were highly rated. They might have advantages in terms of the way income was generated and therefore from the tax system. But all told, we created this very intricate landscape that financial institutions could adjust their issuance and their balance sheet in order to take advantage of every possible arbitrage opportunity. The consequence of that is they got complicated. Remember, Lehman had 2,000 separate chartered entities under the umbrella when it went under. Citi, I think, peaked out at 2,400. Because the institutions got so complicated, it became extremely difficult to regulate them. Because how do you supervise an institution that is so intricate? And indeed, Basel II was an admission of defeat for the very largest institutions. It said, well, we actually can't assess your risk bearing capacity from the outside. You do it with your own model, and then we'll validate your model. Second, it really blunted the force of market discipline, because you're just not sure from the outside the risk characteristics of a financial institution. And that means both in terms of the credit decision, that is, counterparties look to the main name of the holding company, even though it might not, its exposure might be to a different entity. And equity owners didn't, discipline managers. Hence, you had the CEO star status. I find it very instructive in that regard that the least number of hostile takeovers across industries is in finance. Because of big, large, complex financial institutions, a black box from the outside. And the only way you get to pry open the cover is if you own it. And that's risky to somebody from the outside. And then the third thing is, when you get a real complicated organization, it's all sorts of principal agent problems internally. It's just hard to run. And that is, managers didn't exert sufficient discipline on risk takers. If that's the case, then you wind up with suitability abuses, compensation abuses, bottom line, the people taking risks were not looking out for the longer term interests of the firm. So, you know, so the big picture, you know, is over time, we've let financial institutions get complicated. And in terms of the main, you know, sort of markers on that road, included, you know, to the elevation, giving private entities public purposes, namely the rating agencies, and you know, allowing special purpose vehicles, you know, the SIVs that let firms splinter their balance sheet.
So can we separate out what was happening with markets or instruments versus what was happening with institutions themselves?
Complexity is the result of supply and demand, right? And so I think with regard to institutions, there was a demand for complicated securities because of regulation and accounting and the tax system. Complexity could be supplied because intermediaries, the underwriters, could split up their balance sheet. Because also they could split up their balance sheet, we had this phenomenon of differentiation of underwritten securities. Why? Because nobody gets an above market return selling a commoditized financial product. You want to differentiate your product. So the market part of it is the underwriters created complicated securities because that's what the demand was for. They differentiated as much as possible to get those rents, and they could do it because accounting and regulators let them split up their balance sheet.
So when you say differentiation, are you referring to tranching?
No, in terms of nobody issued, you know, there was very little standardization of the type of securities, and what that meant is they had an illusion of a market price when they really were marked to model. So the differentiation, the tranching relates to the underlying demand for complexity. That is, the final holders wanting high tranche, the highest tranche, because that solved the problem with Basel, gave them an advantage under Basel II, the AAA rating. But the lack of standardization is that each of those instruments were marketed separately, were not standard across that market segment, and therefore didn't trade in one deep and liquid market.
So why would investors demand, you know, and pay rents for more complex instruments?
Because among other things, accounting and the Basel II meant that they could put aside less capital if it was AAA.
Right, but that doesn't mean that it can't be plain vanilla commoditized. Why does it have to be bespoke?
And then I think because it was in the because the supply, that is, the underwriters found it in their advantage to split it up. That was a collective action problem.
I'm sorry, I thought you were saying that, I'm confused. I thought you were saying that the issuers, the underwriters, had an incentive to create very complex instruments because they would get more rents by creating more, and I guess I'm trying to figure out why. Why was complexity itself valued?
Okay. So on the demand, so the final investor side?
Sure.
To the extent that securities could be issued, you know, the high tranches would have AAA, that solved one problem for them. Also, jurisdiction and the form of payments might have tax advantages and other regulatory advantages.
That still sounds like it can be commoditized.
How so?
Well, because if everybody's facing the same regulations.
But the point is, not everybody faces the same regulation, right? You're talking about institutions that may have footprints in hundreds of jurisdictions. It's much of 106 countries, you know, for city, but in terms of jurisdictions, once you get this to the state and province level, it's very complicated. So, a lot of these issues were basically bespoke for two or three final holders.
Right.
That had, you know, so yes, you are right at that top level. You know, at the broadest level, if what they were doing, if underwriters were basically doing is selling AAA status, you would think you'd be able to commoditize that. But they were doing more than that. They were meeting the individual tax and sometimes just payment stream. Right? That is, they didn't want to get paid in the middle of the month, you know, middle day of the month or the middle of the quarter. So they were willing, so the final holders were willing to hold those bespoke issues for the very particular going into every, basically burrowing into every nook and cranny of the accounting, tax, and regulatory system.
And did the Fed appreciate that this was happening?
I doubt that.
Why not?
Oh, well, can I say one other thing?
Yeah.
And in terms of the complexity, you also, the one other big return to complexity is too big to fail. Right? Too big to fail is really being too complicated to fail. At a time of stress, authorities would be worried that an institution was too interconnected in the financial system to allow it to fail. Bear Stearns, after all, wasn't that big an investment bank. But it had provided lots of services and therefore at, you know, March 14th, it was viewed as too interconnected to fail. If you hold more complicated securities, if you underwrite complicated securities, that basically mean you raise the size of your balance sheet, then you raise the hurdle. Basically, you raise the protections around you associated with too big to fail.
So before Bear Stearns, I think there was there expectation in the market that a large investment bank was too big to fail? I mean, I think the Fed lesson the Fed had taken from Drexel was that they could let investment banks fail, and they were consistently saying that they never would do such a thing.
Right.
What was the prior view?
And then there was LTCM, of course, which pushed back against Drexel.
But I guess the question is, do you think that Bear Stearns, just to take that as an example, was Bear Stearns structuring itself to make itself
right.
complicated so that it would get bailed out if it failed?
I think Bear Stearns made itself, you make yourself complicated for lots of reasons. If you're entrenched managers, you make yourself complicated because you're also harder to take over there. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
The more complicated you make yourself, the harder it is to replicate the institution. And the more complicated you make yourself, the more leverage you have with regulators. Now, I don't think Bear Stearns was betting too much on too big to fail, but complexity gave it an advantage with regulators. And remember, when you think about it, think about how much the industry pushed back against any attempt to commoditize its product, any attempt to lessen systemic risk. Like, you know, Geithner was trying at the New York Fed to reduce the backlog account of uncleared derivatives contracts. Part of what they wanted was more standardization of the contract.
And how did industry push back?
How did they push back?
How does that actually work in practical terms, them pushing back?
Because they got into a big room and listened to exhortations from staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and then said, well, no, our customers really wouldn't like it. They like the advantages of having non-standardized products. Maybe we should create another work stream to look into this. But, you know, we all have complicated calendars, and let's schedule the next meeting for a year from now.
And then would the New York Fed schedule a meeting from a year from then?
Would the
I guess I'm trying to figure out how this works. I'm trying to figure out how a financial industry actually exerts its influence. Or does it?
You want the simplest one?
Sure.
The simplest example is only in the bank world, but there is no standardized record of deposits, right? So, what is the game plan for the FDIC to resolve a large financial institution? They pay everybody the insurance. Everyone listed as an account holder, which means that if you opened up an account at one bank with your first, middle, and last name, your first initial, another account with your first name and your last name, another account with your initials, it would be very difficult for the FDIC to appreciate that, in fact, you had multiple accounts with the same institution. Why? Because for 30 years, when the FDIC, and supported by the Federal Reserve, would put proposals out that every depository institution would have a uniform record of depositors, the industry complained to the regulators, complained to the Congress, saying that would be too costly.
Right?
So in this regard, things like clearinghouses where you don't have explicit regulatory power, like the Federal Reserve Bank of New York might probably didn't in many of those things, they can just say no or they can just delay.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I guess I'm trying to, again, put, you know, we talk a lot, you know, there's lots in the ether about the power of the financial industry. And, you know, anything that you can do to sort of help us understand how that works in practical terms is helpful. Were there times where you saw the financial industry, where you personally saw the financial industry try to exert its influence?
Obviously, the uniform deposit record is got a long history.
Yeah.
But by the way, what effectively it does, it lowers the bar for being too big to fail as a depository institution, because it'd be easier for the FDIC to carry an institution, it changes your understanding of what least cost resolution is. If administratively, it's just hard to do.
But I guess I'm more thinking about, like, when you're talking about when President Geithner, you know, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
You think about, you know, Jerry Cargan's groups. Wrote two reports on the problems of clearing backlogs in the derivatives market. And I think you just look at the sequence of how long or not at all were those recommendations taken.
And you think part of the reason that those recommendations weren't taken is because the financial industry didn't, you know, fought against them?
Yeah.
So now I want to ask the question that I asked before again, which is how much of the fragilities in the system, if you would use that word, how much of the fragilities in the system did the Fed appreciate over the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s?
I think that the blossoming of special purpose vehicles was underappreciated. It was supposed to, in fact, be a mechanism to limit risk at the depository. But what was not appreciated was that although it may be an accounting sense, have no and a contractual sense, have no recourse to the holding company, to the initiating holding company, there was a reputational risk that was significant. So I think that was underappreciated.
Is there something you can point to as to why it was underappreciated? Or did they just miss? Were all systems working and they just missed it, or did somehow the system not work for regulators to see it?
It was just unappreciated. I don't think regulars. I did not appreciate the extent to which the contractual form did not actually insulate the firm from its SPV.
So which cases are you talking about? The CIVs at Citigroup are an example. Are there other significant cases where that was a factor?
What do you mean in terms of?
Well, in terms of support being provided for reputational reasons, I can think of the CIVs at Citi, and I can think of money market funds being supported by commercial banks.
Right. Yeah.
And
the hedge funds at Bear Stearns.
And then Bear Stearns' hedge funds.
And the hedge funds at Bear Stearns.
So those are pretty much the examples.
Yeah.
Okay.
But again, I guess my point is, if you thought. Right. So the ease to which an underwriting entities could create the special purpose vehicles meant that it was easier for them. We didn't fully appreciate the cost associated with that, and therefore allowed them to get more complicated more quickly. So it's related.
And okay, so do you mind if I switch gears a bit? No? Okay. So switching gears a bit, you've written that what we had was a solvency problem and not a liquidity problem. And can you talk about that a little bit? Because some people just, would say it absolutely the opposite way. We had a liquidity crisis, there was panic in the markets, there was a, freeze up in liquidity, and that's why we had a crisis. And, you're saying quite the opposite. So I think you're saying quite the opposite.
By and large. So, and that, again, what's the market price? And if, one reason TARP ran and was redirected in purpose was exactly the issue is you have the market clearing price, you have the price consistent with fundamentals and a return to risk aversion and less uncertainty, and then you have the price if held to maturity. And the notion, and so I assume what you might hear from is that these institutions might have technically been insolvent at fire sale prices, but fire sale prices weren't appropriate. As a good example, I date the start of the financial crisis to August 1st, 2007, when Bear Stearns tried to hold that auction of securities held by its two hedge funds and had to stop the auction because there wasn't a market clearing price. I think that financial authorities were too willing to raise their own estimate of the true value of underlying securities relative to the market than was appropriate. And if market prices were closer to being true, then Bear Stearns was insolvent.
But why did Bear Stearns, I guess the liquidity crisis maybe comes when, sure, maybe Bear Stearns failed because it was insolvent, maybe AIG failed because it was insolvent, but why did their failures create a crisis? And I think maybe that's where folks start saying, because the failures of those firms created a liquidity crisis.
Right.
Does that?
And a party withdrawal and all those things, right?
I mean, does that sound right? That an insolvency crisis led to a liquidity crisis?
Sure.
Okay. Okay.
My complaint isn't about governmental action. My complaint is that by having misdiagnosed the original problem, they used the wrong instruments and used them in a way that potentially made the run worse.
So what do you mean?
Right.
Which wrong instruments?
Okay. Well, first of all, Bear Stearns is a liquidity problem means perhaps it's appropriate to use lender of last resort, because lender of last resort is all about illiquidity. It's all about asserting that there's value in the underlying collateral and temporary support is in fact solves a market failure. If you think instead the institution is insolvent, you think instead about the immediate fiscal cost and the right resolution mechanism.
And
it should have been the Treasury involved if the government were to be involved, and it should have involved the resolution by setting the precedent of Bear Stearns and then following up with the primary dealer credit facility. It created the perception of aid to investment banks that made Lehman what Lehman was in the end.
So you think that the rescue was not the right resolution?
Oh, no, it was not the right resolution. And I would also say that we still don't have a good understanding of the alternatives that were possible. We're told either Bear Stearns, purchased by JPMC is facilitated by the Fed, or there's complete and total market chaos. I find it hard to believe that there weren't things in between.
Do you think that were things in between discussed, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. I go back to LTCM, right? LTCM was problematic. It was sort of a marker in a number of ways, but including the fact that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York helped facilitation of the private sector deal actually changed the incentives of LTCM's management in a way that they turned down an offer that was on the table. We don't know, we've only been presented the two extreme cases, and it's just still not clear what alternatives were investigated. Hmm. And it was consequential then.
Was that in itself a failure to not have, plans B and C?
Yes. Or if there was a plan B and C, then it was a failure to communicate, particularly to the Congress, about the alternatives. And the failure, went also to the communication of what they did. I mean, for the first, the Federal Reserve for a long time continued to characterize it as a loan to bear through JPMC, which was really an attempt to obscure its support to an investment bank.
So was there something inherently fragile about the investment bank model? I mean, the reliance on hot money that was revealed by this crisis and would have ultimately been revealed by some other crisis?
Well, it was the maturity structural liabilities and the use of leverage. Right, so you can rely on hot money if you have a lot of capital.
But they were adequately capitalized by their regulatory standards.
So I think the regulatory standard was wrong, right?
And why do you think was the regulatory standard just wrong sort of ex post we got unlucky? Or is there a reason to sort of peel back that one layer of the onion of why were the regulatory standards wrong?
I think Bear Stearns investment banks had too low a capital requirement, and that in part reflected the problems of having multiple regulators and regulatory competition. Why does the SEC regulate those financial holding companies? And the answer is, under Basel II, they needed a lead regulator. And if it wasn't a U.S. regulator, it would have to, by default, be the FSA. They didn't want the FSA, the industry didn't want the regulator to be the FSA, so they went to the SEC and asked, what kind of regulator would you be? And the result was a low capital one.
So again, I keep coming with them back to the same question of what did the Fed, when you were there, what did the Fed appreciate about this? I mean, so those capital standards were known. It was probably pretty transparent that these investment banks were really highly leveraged. The Fed knew about the size of the repo market, roughly speaking, size of the CP market. What, you know, was the Fed worried?
The Fed created a section that was to look into systemic risk. It started a regular report on internal report on financial stability. It did do stress tests given the available information of the depository sector. So I think there was an understanding that there's a responsibility for systemic risk. However, investment banks were not regulated by the Fed. A lot of the stuff did fall, reflects a lack of coordination across regulators.
But I guess I'm just going to push on this a little bit more. I mean, the lack of coordination among regulators is a long discussed issue. I mean, the patchwork quilt, the regulatory arbitrage, all of these things have been in the ether for a long time. And were there people at the Fed sounding the alarm?
No, I don't think so. I think there were people at the Fed trying to use the President's Working Group as a vehicle to coordinate more closely across the regulators, but it's the Secretary of the Treasury is the head of that group.
Yeah.
And indeed, it varied over time by who was Secretary.
Yep. And it seems that there was more of a reliance over time. You were talking about how these institutions became so incredibly complex that they were, it was impossible to regulate them, and that Basel II was an admission of defeat, as you put it. There was also, it seems, more of a reliance over time on self-regulation,
also in Basel II.
So was that a good idea? In retrospect. I mean, or do you have any, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, do you have opinions on that in retrospect?
So I think there was an intersection of two failures. The first failure was the view that reliance on markets would impose sufficient discipline so that firms working just in their own self-interest would try to make it would make themselves resilient at a time of market stress. The second, so there really was a there was a view that firms will do that themselves because nobody wants to fail. The second part, though, was an underappreciation of the extent to which self-interest was also making the financial system complicated so that the first premise didn't hold.
Yeah.
We did know the first premise didn't hold. I mean, we did see firms trying to protect themselves.
But didn't hold effectively.
What it would do to the market.
That we had, right. That they were more exposed to risks and also systemic risks because of the issue, because of how complicated they got. So we thought they would self-regulate. We missed the extent to which that was hard to do when they were complicated.
Do you think, is there a role of compensation here, whether it's structures or levels or anything? Should we be focusing at all on their compensation structures at these firms?
I think compensation abuses and are in part also evidence of the monitoring problems with complicated firms and the lack of market discipline associated with the complexity of firms. Because the first answer you normally would give is compensation structure is something the equity owners are supposed to care about because that's their disciplining device. But if the firms are real complicated and that market discipline is blunted, then you get bad compensation structures.
Well, and indeed,
so the issue is whether you say, bad compensation structures is something the government's got to fix, or why is there bad compensation structures? What deeper failure is there?
I mean, what's interesting is that compensation structures over time became more and more tied to equity price, to share price.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read lots of papers about how that's a really good thing and it helps to align incentives. But as you were saying, if equity owners, you know, either don't have the information expertise or for whatever reason aren't disciplining firms, then we have no reason to believe that the equity price really does incorporate the, you know, all available information and it reflects the true, you know, expected net present value of all future cash flows, blah, blah, blah. And what that all sort of comes down to is that this isn't a good compensation structure.
Right. But again, so my question is, does that mean you intervene directly about the compensation structure, or do you try to figure out what are the barriers in place that make equity owners not exert the appropriate discipline? Hmm. It's due to compensation. And so I would say I wouldn't cut directly to the compensation structure and say if you fix that, you fix the problem. Because that, to me, is the manifestation of a deeper problem. And if all you do is change compensation, then you're going to wind up not fixing the problem because it'll show up elsewhere in the imperfect, you know, in the poor monitoring.
So one of the themes that we've been pursuing is that the housing market was one match that could have set off dry tinder in the market, but there could have been others. And that in some ways the financial system was just inherently fragile. And one of the ways was excessive leverage in hidden ways, and another way was reliance on very short-term money. How do you view that, and is that something that the Fed was focusing on?
Okay. I think that housing was an important trigger because it went to the heart of the credit problems. That we had a significant destruction of wealth when the tech bubble burst, but we didn't have a financial crisis because essentially that equity wasn't, the equity in the tech industry wasn't critical collateral in the leverage process. The equity in the housing sector was critical to the collateral in the credit sector. Mm-hmm. So I think it is possible to imagine a crisis emerging, praying, you know, and being amplified by leverage. It's hard, you know. I think the initiating shocks are harder to, you know, were more important when it involves something, involved housing and its importance in the collateral in so many of these instruments.
But was it something new in the financial system that any asset had the importance that, that the housing assets did in leverage? I mean, it's, I think we understood from the repo market that, you know, traditionally it would have just been treasuries and agencies, but that that changed in the 2000s. I mean, was this all just new, this financial fragility?
All right, so there's a couple points there. One is, you know, look, as a nation, we over-subsidize housing. We want housing to be important. We made housing an important sector. We facilitated through the GSEs housing finance and the securitization of that, and we were happy about, you know, and policymakers and politicians were happy about securitization of housing-related products because it seemed to further foster that national goal. So on the real side, that, I mean, there is an issue. We do over-subsidize. I think what you also want to remember is the international context. That the Asian crisis in 1998, there was a massive demand for reserves in the Pacific Rim, added to by the Middle East, given the rise in energy prices. The massive increase in reserves took the form of U.S. dollars, and you don't buy dollars, you buy riskless assets denominated in dollars, namely government securities. We were running large current account deficits, even as at the end of last century, we had a budget deficit, a surplus. So if the foreign official sector wanted government securities, and we weren't making money government securities, they were pulling out government securities from the private hands. The rating of government securities has a particular advantage in Basel. So rocket scientists filled the void by creating asset-backed securities, tranching asset-backed securities. So so one reason that housing collateral became so important in securitization and finance is foreign official entities were buying the best natural AAA instruments, government securities, leaving a void to create constructed AAA securities. That is more the high rated tranches of asset backed securities.
So when you talk about housing being collateral when, you know, tech stocks were not serving as collateral, should I be thinking of that as collateral to a homeowner's mortgage or collateral in the repo market and the asset backed securities market and, you know, various sort of debt markets between, you know, investors or institutions?
Yeah, so that's what I was thinking. So the mortgage is what makes possible your purchase of a house, but the mortgage is also the raw material of finance.
It is
the collateral for securities.
Right.
And so if you do something that impairs house prices, it impairs the value of the mortgage, therefore it impairs the value of the collateral in these securities.
Right. So in some ways, the credit bubble is not, you know, it sounds like, would you say that the credit bubble isn't really even so critical as a mortgage credit bubble among homeowners, but a credit bubble in financial markets?
I mean, obviously they intersect, right?
Yes,
the increased reliance on mortgages as collateral made the financial sector vulnerable to a collateral shock.
That makes sense. So I have monetary policy questions. I want to make sure none of my colleagues have other sort of supervision, regulation, financial structures. Okay, fine. All right, so monetary policy. So I'm going to try to badly, well, you know what, I'm not going to try to badly paraphrase what I think your views are. I'm going to ask you to describe your views on the steepness of the yield curve and why that mattered for the crisis.
Okay. So we're talking how much of the seeds of all this were sown in 2002 and 2003 and 2004?
Yes, sure, yes.
Okay. So on one level, I don't take the criticisms of somebody like John Taylor particularly seriously. We're talking about the setting of the federal funds rate. What matters for asset markets are longer-term maturities and a Fed funds rate that was a little low relative to some recommendations from a model probably has a small effect on the capital value of homes. And the fact is, if you look at the correlation of the monthly change in the funds rate from 1996 to 2006 with the 10-year treasury rate or the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, it was effectively zero to slightly negative. Capital market rates are set in capital markets. What they care about is the path for the funds rate, and if the funds rate is low for a little bit, then it's going to have to be higher later on, and it doesn't have much effect on the 10-year rate. Thinking back on June 30th, 2004, just before the Fed started tightening policy, the financial markets had priced in 300 basis points of tightening over the next a year and a half. It was in fact exactly what the FOMC delivered subsequently, so almost all of the tightening, the gradual tightening that began in the middle of 2004 was exactly predicted in markets. It was exactly predicted in markets, and it was priced into capital market rates. The Fed had an objective of maximum employment and stable prices. Monetary policy works through an interest rate channel. It was a jobless recovery, and the tech sector was impaired. So providing sufficient stimulus for the macroeconomy meant keeping rates low and fostering the expansion of house prices and housing activity. So at that level, I would plead not guilty. Monetary policy had, no major role in shaping the housing bubble. It was supportive. I think that's, you have to say that, but it was supportive because Congress told the Federal Reserve maximum employment and stable prices. In retrospect, I think that policy gradualism was a problem. That by raising the short rate only slowly and gradually, as suggested in lots of macro models, the policy gradualism is an anomaly in models. You probably should make your policy rate a random walk. The only thing you know at this meeting relative to last meeting is news, and therefore you should move your policy rate according to news, because there shouldn't be any adjustment costs. But anyway, I think policy gradualism isn't all that it's cut out to be. By raising the funds rate at quarter point increments slowly over 2 years, the Fed kept the yield curve steeper than it would have been had it acted more aggressively, and it also damped down on the volatility of money market rates. That encouraged a short-termism in market, the carry trade. It encouraged adjustable rate mortgages, and that helped help facilitate the credit bubble. So it wasn't so much a first moment argument, it's a second moment argument. The Fed, the FOMC had about the right path for monetary right path for the net effect of policy tightening, but they did it by raising the funds rate slowly and convincing everybody it would ultimately raise a lot. They probably would have been better off if they just raised it more quickly.
And so, one of the arguments about the Fed funds rate not being set appropriately is that the Fed had the wrong view of inflation. It was measuring inflation incorrectly because it wasn't putting enough weight on asset prices, just as part of that inflation measure.
Right.
Does that?
Asset prices and monetary policy go back. You know, that's a debate that goes back a long time. There's actually a more technical issue too. The Fed at that time had a fascination with the PCE price index, and in fact, the concerns about disinflation in 2003 and 2004 in part got revised away. The inflation rate they were looking at in real time subsequently got revised, so there was less disinflation pressures than previously understood. So the first thing I'd list is looking at a price index that doesn't get revised. Asset prices and monetary policy, at the time the Fed really did believe, or senior officials at the Fed believe in the syllogism, you make monetary policy based on where you think asset prices are headed, but you don't move your policy rate by more than macro conditions warranted based on a concern about asset prices. You got other mechanisms, namely supervision and regulation and presumably moral suasion. So, first order, it wasn't a monetary policy problem, it was supervision and regulation.
So before I get to one other question, I do have to say, just going back to my roots, that the PCE deflator may be revised, but the fact that the CPI deflator is not revised doesn't necessarily mean that it's a more accurate view of reality. It just means that it's stuck in its incorrectness.
Right. Sure. That's exactly right. However, if the Fed had been putting more weight on the CPI rather than the PCE at that time, it would not have had as much concern about unwanted disinflation.
So as painful as a counterfactual is, go back to 2004, maybe even 2005, and, let's say that the Fed has a crystal ball that says, it really is a housing bubble, it really is going to crash, it's not, house prices aren't going to flatline, they're really going to crash. Would the Fed have done anything different with monetary policy?
Okay, I would say that in August 2007, Governor Rick Mishkin thought he had a crystal ball and wrote a Jackson Hole paper that said a 25% decline in housing prices could, according to the staff model, be handled by just lowering the funds rate faster. So it's not clear to me that knowing that house prices went down a lot would be sufficient to have materially changed the stance of policy. It would have, I assume, increased the pressure on soup and reg.
So then,
and increased the pressure through the president's working group to have make sure the institutions were resilient.
So now that segues perfectly into the Greenspan put. So the fact that there was there was, I'm guessing that you would agree that there was confidence for market participants that the Fed would effectively be able to lower the Fed funds rate fast enough to clean up whatever shock might occur. Do you think that's an accurate perception? Do you think that perception, helped to influence behavior? Was it a good perception for markets to have?
Well, but stepping back a little bit, we were living through the Great Moderation. And if you believed in the Great Moderation and you attributed at least a portion of it to monetary policymakers, then you probably believe that you could take more risk, that uncertainty was lower, and you needed less capital. It's ironic. There are plenty of testimonies by Alan Greenspan saying that quiet times bear the seeds of its own problems, and that I remember in 1997 talking about the very low risk spreads as something that people will look back on regret because tranquil times don't hold forever. That's a conundrum, if we could coin it, use a phrase, delivering a stable macro background may make investors overconfident and financial institutions less resilient to shocks. What's the alternative? From a monetary policy standpoint, it doesn't sound like the right alternative is to jitter the federal funds rate so that people appreciate risk. The alternative is, what you're supposed to do is pair the macro tranquility you've produced with effective supervision and regulation. When times are good, it's very tough to make that case.
So since you brought up Chairman Greenspan, thinking about times being good and the system working, he looked at a number of these financial innovations, including what was happening in derivatives markets, what was happening in securitization, and he has speeches where he talks about how these innovations were helping to diversify risk, that they were actually, very beneficial to markets.
Right, but that goes back earlier to the two things that intersected. The belief that firms can control, that markets discipline firms and firms acted in the best interest of shareholders. That is, market innovation was a good thing, and we could count on that to make firms resilient. Plus, the individual incentives toward complexity that made the first thing harder. I don't think anybody really appreciated that second factor.
And so I'm running out of questions, but one of my last ones, so you've got good times going for a while. You've got the Great Moderation. The Fed is putting out papers, as you say, as late as 2007, that it can clean up a shock with a lower Fed funds rate successfully. Was the Fed looking hard enough for risks? And I guess was there a culture at the Fed to question and be concerned, and were there I don't want to be too leading, but I mean, I guess I'm, was part of the problem, was part of the reason that this was missed is because of the culture at the Fed?
I think that Alan Binder's characterization when he was vice chair that all the divisions were silos headed by and that there wasn't enough communication across is probably true. That there's a real side forecast, there's an assessment of monetary policy, in another building there's bank supervision, and they really didn't interact very much. I think to the credit first of Roger Ferguson and then Ben Bernanke, they really did try to move the culture. One of the recommendations coming out of the Lessons Learned project on September 11th, was a sense that the Fed needed a better understanding of systemic risks and risks to non-depository institutions and risks that cut across markets. Now, it was mostly coming from basically a real shock, but part of that was trying to understand that therefore how failure in one node would propagate through the system. And one of the recommendations from the Ferguson Task Force was do more coordination, try to understand systemic risks. And the board did create a new section to do that, to focus on systemically important non-depository institutions, and that when Chairman Bernanke came in, one of his first requests was a regular report on financial stability and systemic risk. But that was pushing against the culture that everybody ran their own shop.
So do you remember debates at the Fed that you were a part of about whether or not the Fed should be doing more to regulate different parts of the system?
Regulate more, not really. Understand more, yes. Coordinate more with agencies, yes. I was there during an era of deregulation. That was the, prevailing view, that market instruments were providing mechanisms for shedding risk. We could use those market instruments to evaluate the amount of risk outstanding and then get real-time readings, and therefore, we could rely on market discipline.
So we've heard that this was the era of deregulation. What deregulatory measures in particular were taken, or is it more an atmosphere of just not challenging the industry?
I mean, an atmosphere of not challenging the industry. The SEC was lower, did have low capital. I think it was pushing back against, I think where there were issues of drawn regulatory lines, it really wasn't in my shop, so I can't really speak to it. But there was a sequence of potential revisions to the CEA, and that elicited a number of testimonies over the course of time.
So you mentioned the Ferguson Task Force. That sounds like something interesting that we should ask for. I'm not sure if I'm familiar. What was the title of that report? Can you tell us where to find that?
Well, I mean, it must be all, it should be, I mean, it's past 5 years, so it's not, what's it called? It was called, and it's reflect, I mean, it was discussed in the budget documents because it was one reason the Fed got bigger.
I'm sure we can find it.
Yeah, and it's lessons learned from the events of September 11th. And most of those lessons were about infrastructure. That's when the Federal Reserve started doubling down on its provision of Fed funds and Fed funds and book entry system services that is having more and more redundancy with regard to open market operations. But the board did create a new section and did produce a financial stability report. The other place, in terms of the Fed's discussion, the FOMC did have in one of its two-day meetings, have staff presentations on the housing market.
So I, when was this?
When was this? It was probably in, probably in 2005. You can figure it out from the minutes. The minutes would have a paragraph that said they had this discussion.
Yep.
And so there was issues about what were the risks associated with securitization, and what would happen if house prices go down, who would be underwater, who not, that sort of thing.
So I think our last question, one of the things that Chairman Greenspan said when he was testifying in front of us was that, you know, whatever the Federal Reserve might have thought about the housing market, there was no way that he could go to Congress and advocate for regulating the housing market more, that, you know, the environment was such he just would have been completely shot down. Did the Fed feel pressure either on the housing front or on any other front from the congressional climate?
Oh, sure. No question about it. I think that the hearings, and the easiest way to look see that is just look at the distribution of questions in the chairman's semi-annual monetary policy testimonies. That in the early part of the 2000s, a minority of questions were about monetary policy and interest rates. They were about regulatory matters. They were about issues like, you know, industrial loan corporations, about Fannie and Freddie, about the Commodity Exchange Act, truth, you know, TILA type regulations. I don't exactly remember the exact. I think it was Regulation B. I mean, the board got something. I think it was 34,000 comment letters. When it tried to make, when it put out a regulation that would make a modest change in disclosure, and that was held up for months and months and months as a result. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a brave chairperson who went before, and this is particularly true on the House side. Those testimonies were just awful, because the House Financial Services Committee had a different view about regulation and used that as a forum to press Chairman Greenspan in particular, but I think Chairman Bernanke had problems too. I think it would be a brave chairperson to get in front of a committee like that and say, you know, we build too many houses, we don't regulate them enough, and or that house prices are too high.
Hmm. Well, is there anything else you want to tell us?
No, I think that about covered it.
We covered a lot of ground. So this has been enormously helpful and really interesting. So thank you so much for taking all this time for us.
Okay.
And thank you for your fantastic RA.
Okay.
I'm
working out.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Okay. Bye.